WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, crossing Antarctica on skis, we talk with Norwegian adventurer Borge Ausland about his 64-day trek across the continent. It set a record for being the first solo, unsupported crossing without the use of sled dogs or supplies dropped by air. Though he did get a little help from Jimi Hendrix. Also, the abortion controversy. We talk with Village Voice reporter Jennifer Gonerman about the journal of an Operation Rescue member which got into the hands of a pro-choice activist. And Peter Korn tells us about a year in the life of an abortion clinic, the subject of his new book. That's coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The widow and children of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. say they would support a request by his confessed assassin for a new trial. At a news conference in Atlanta, King's son Dexter said he intends to meet with James Earl Ray to hear his story. The King family is expected to petition a Tennessee judge to grant Ray a trial. Ray is serving a 99-year sentence for killing the civil rights leader. The chairman of American Airlines says a strike by the airline's pilots may be unavoidable now. The company has announced plans to accommodate travelers in the event of a walkout, which would shut down American. Dave Mattingly reports.
The airline has already canceled most international flights as of tomorrow, with the exceptions of London and San Juan, Puerto Rico. Company spokesman Al Camo says passengers booked on American Airlines flights have several options should its 9,000 pilots go on strike.
If travel plans cannot be deferred, passengers can request full refunds on tickets for any canceled American Airlines flight, provided they have not been used on another airline. If passengers must travel during a strike, American will attempt to reaccommodate them on other airlines that have seats available.
American Airlines is the nation's largest domestic airline. It carries 200,000 passengers a day on its 2,200 routes worldwide. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
During funeral services this morning at the Washington National Cathedral, President Clinton eulogized Ambassador Pamela Harriman as a patriot, public servant, and citizen of the world. Mr. Clinton said he owes his presidency in part to Harriman's fundraising ability. She died last week in Paris after suffering a stroke. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu meets with the president at the White House this afternoon. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
With Israeli-Palestinian peace talks apparently back on track, Mr. Netanyahu wants to resume the Israeli-Syrian negotiations, which have been stalled for a year. He has ruled out a return of the Golan Heights to Syria, which Damascus demands as its price for peace, but Mr. Netanyahu is said to have some compromises in mind and will discuss them with President Clinton. Syrian officials say they are not interested in territorial compromise. U.S. officials are eager to rekindle the Israeli-Syrian negotiations while strengthening ties between Israel and its other Arab neighbors. With that in mind, President Clinton has invited Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, and King Hussein of Jordan to the White House over the next few weeks. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is getting close to the 7,000 mark. It's up 31 points right now at 6,992 in heavy trading. On the Nasdaq, the composite index is up 9. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, the Commerce Department says retail sales rebounded moderately in January after a holiday sales season that was much weaker than previously thought. Retail sales were up 0.6% last month. December's figures were revised downward to an anemic 0.3% gain. The chairman of the Federal Reserve is again calling for a breakdown of the barriers that keep banks from competing with Wall Street firms. Bloomberg's Dave Ahern reports.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan said Congress should tear down most of the remaining barriers between banks and securities firms. Greenspan spoke before a House banking subcommittee headed by New Jersey Congresswoman Marge Rokema. According to Greenspan, technology is sweeping away barriers between banks and securities firms, and Congress should recognize that by repealing a 60-year-old law that separates the industries. But Greenspan also said Congress must be careful to keep federal government deposit guarantees at banks from being extended to brokerages. Dave Ahern on Capitol Hill.
Walmart has lost a labor dispute in Canada and is now faced with its first unionized store ever. A provincial labor board ruled that Walmart pressured workers by implicitly threatening to close its Windsor, Ontario branch if they voted to unionize. The board has ordered immediate certification of the United Steelworkers Union to represent workers at the Windsor store. Russians who have taken a liking to Cherry Garcia and Rainforest Crunch are soon going to be without their supply of Ben & Jerry's ice cream. The Moscow Times reports the Vermont-based company has decided to pull out of Russia after 5 years because of high operating costs. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations. Contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of technology, industry, and economic growth.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. And this is the sound of Borge Alslan trekking his way across the ice and snow-covered surface of Antarctica. On a good day, this is what Alslan heard on his Walkman.
All right. Now dig this, baby. You don't care for me. I don't care about that.
Last month, with the help of Jimi Hendrix, Borge Alslan became the first person to trek solo across the Antarctic continent, without the support of air supplies, sled dogs, or motorized transport. For 64 days, Alslan cross-country skied an average of 10 hours a day, facing temperatures which dropped to minus 63 degrees Fahrenheit, while dragging a 400-pound sled loaded with supplies. He follows in a long tradition of Norwegian polar explorers, most notably Roald Amundsen, the first person to reach the South Pole. Alslan is a deep sea diver by profession and lives with his wife and son in Oslo. In addition to his new Antarctic record, he's also the first person to complete solo unsupported treks to both the North and the South Pole. I asked him how the two ends of the Earth differ.
Well, the big difference is actually that the North Pole is an ocean surrounded by landmass, and the South Pole is a landmass surrounded by ocean. And when you walk to the North Pole, you're actually walking on a thin layer of ice, and it's constantly moving and breaking up, creating pressure ridges and open water. And the situations are much more different than from the South Pole, because the South Pole is a big glacier. It's 10,000 feet thick at the pole itself, and you're moving in a very monotone landscape. And while the challenges at the North Pole are maybe more instant and unpredictable, the challenges on the South Pole, it's like it's patience, it's just to keep going day after day, and maybe a more mental challenge, I would think.
I imagine Antarctica as an endless variation on white, on the color white. What does it look like?
It is, yeah, you're right. And but also the sky is blue and extremely beautiful. You have lots of variations in the sky. And I think it's the way you look at it, you have two choices. You can say that it's just white, cold, and horrible, and it will be that way. But you can also say it's beautiful. And if you look for variations in the sky, and if you look for things carved out in the snow by the wind, and I actually had a competition with myself that every day I had to find a nice piece of art in the snow, and when I did that, it was beautiful. And that's the kind of approach you really need to be able to go through that very lonely and cold landscape.
I imagine preparation must be crucial in a solo trek, no matter where you are. How long did you prepare for the trip across Antarctica?
2 years. I actually tried this expedition last year and I failed, so this was my second attempt. And preparation is probably the most crucial part, and I think that's what's divided me from the others who have tried that. I'm very thorough with the preparations and I have a lot of experience. And you have to do all the things yourself because you're the only one who knows how you want it, so it's a lot of work.
I read somewhere that you, maybe it wasn't for this trek, that you shaved down the bristles on your toothbrush to make it lighter because weight is so crucial.
I did actually do that on this trip, but that was to fit it in my pocket. It was not to save weight, but that's the kind of attitude you need, because you have to save every ounce and gram you can save. You really have to save. And so if you keep that attitude, you will in the end up with only the essential equipment, and you leave all the other stuff behind. And when you're starting off with 400 pounds, yeah, you can imagine that every kilo counts.
Did you have any last-minute additions, those kind of moments where you say, oh my God, how could I have forgotten that before you you took off?
I made one wrong choice, and that was my ski boots. I had two pairs of ski boots, and I took the wrong one. But and the sole cracked on the ski boots. I was able to repair it, but that caused a lot of... the whole world was falling apart when I saw that crack underneath the ski boots. But so I should have taken the other one, of course. But since I had the repair kit with me, I was able to lash it together with parachute cord, so it stayed good all the way. But apart from that, it wasn't anything I would have done differently.
For one of your expeditions, you drank a glass of pure olive oil for breakfast every day for a year to accustom your body to absorbing fat. What on earth gave you that idea?
That's part of the preparation, because my diet is opposite of everybody else's diet. In society now, you have to eat as little fat as possible, but on me, for my trek, I would burn maybe 7,000 calories a day. And because fat is higher in calories per gram, you need to take a lot of fat on the trip, but you also need to make your body accustomed to burning fat instead of carbohydrates. And also because it's better to have 10 kilos extra weight on your body instead of in the sledge as energy. I try to bulk up before I leave, and I also try to make my body adjusted to the high percentage of fat. So that's why I actually drank olive oil as a part of the preparation.
So did it work?
It did work, yeah. I gained 10 kilos and I lost 15.
Do you get an endorphin high every day as you exercise? The same way runners talk about an endorphin high?
No, I don't, because you're actually breaking down the body from day one. So you get more and more tired during the trek, and your muscle gets more and more stiff and more tired, and it's more and more difficult to get going in the morning. So I think it's probably the opposite.
Tell me what your daily routine was like.
The routine is very, very important, and I tend to stick to a very strict routine. So when the going is rough, I know that I have this routine to follow. I know that I have to go 10 hours a day, no matter what, and just surviving from hour to hour and just do the job. So the routine is merely waking up in the morning, having my porridge, breaking camp, and set off skiing for 1.5 hours, and then I have 10 minutes break. I take some food and drink, and I keep on going for 1.5 hours, and I do this procedure for 10 hours. Then I put up my small tent, secure it well, and put snow around it, so if the weather gets bad, it won't blow away. I go inside, I make my dinner, and that time I have my only relaxing time. I have a couple of hours in the evening where I can listen to some music, I can read. I had some books with me. And then it's 8 hours sleep, and I stick to those 8 hours because I need the energy. I need to be a little bit ahead of myself when I had to make decisions during the day. So that's a very, very important thing to keep the routine.
Well, what were your biggest obstacles? The weather?
No, not the weather. I think the weather was pretty bad this time. It was actually worse than last year, but I have good clothing, I have good equipment, so I was prepared for that. I think crevasses is one of the biggest obstacles, and also the constant danger. You're always balancing on a fine line between success and failure, and you have to make a lot of evaluations, and you have to evaluate the risk, and you have to take chances. It's impossible to go through and such an expedition without taking chances, and you just have to take the right chances.
Give me an example.
Like?
Of a chance you took.
Crevasses, they are often covered by snow, and they can be crevassed fields which are very extensive, and you have to go through it, right through it. And you're coming to a snow bridge, which are the crevasses. They're like deep fissures in the ice. They can be 100 feet or more deep, and if you fall down, you will certainly die. And you want to go, but you want to reach your goal, so you have to go through the area, and you have a choice maybe of crossing a snow bridge, or you have the choice of walking 2 miles around the crevasse. And I tend to be on the safe side and thinking that it's better to arrive one day later than never to arrive.
Did you fall in any crevasses?
Not this time. Not this time. Last year I had an accident in a crevasse, but not this time.
What happened when you fell on that trip?
I was going from an island called Birkner Island, and I was going to cross from the island to the Ross Ice Shelf, which is a moving piece of ice. And just when in the edge of the island, I went through a crevasse, but I went through with one ski, and the other ski rested on the other bank, and also was supported by my dragging bars, which are connected me to the sledge. So I didn't go all the way down, but it was just like a trapdoor, and it happened so suddenly. The ski just went straight through, and I was lying there across this crevasse, and it was a pretty scary moment.
Borge Ausland is my guest. This January, he became the first person to cross Antarctica alone and unsupported, that means without the help of sled dogs or food drops or other outside assistance. We're going to take a short break now, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Norwegian adventurer Borge Ausland. He just became the first person to complete a solo, unsupported trek across Antarctica. You skied on cross-country skis and had the help of parasails attached to around your waist, I imagine?
Yeah, it's like, if you can imagine, like a parachute. And I had two, one 12 square meter and 124 square meter, so I could use it in different kinds of wind speed. And I attached it to my waist, and the sledge was obviously behind me, so I was kind of in the middle and trying to steer this thing. And it's actually not so easy as it sounds, because you have to keep balance, you have to keep direction, and you have to steer the parasail, and the wind is changing, and you have to be very careful not to sail in too strong winds, because you can damage yourself or get dragged away by the parasail and get knocked unconscious or something. So that was actually, among crevasses, that was actually one of the most dangerous things I did. But it was when the wind was good and stable, I had some very good progress with the parasail.
Well, give us an idea of what the sensation is like. Is it very bumpy because of the ice?
Yeah, it's can be very bumpy depending on the surface, but if I had the big parasail up and I had low winds and good surface, and I had Jimi Hendrix, the ultimate experience, on my Walkman, it was just a great sensation.
What else did you take that I guess you'd count among non-essentials, things that you took because they're essential to you in terms of staying sane?
Yeah, that was, I think, the tapes was very important. I had actually 30 tapes, so I should maybe cut some down to save weight on the tapes, but I tend to also to try to socialize and have a little bit extra on that side. So 30 tapes, lots of different rock and roll music. Well, you have Tom Petty, Into the Great Wide Open, and also Rolling Stones, Time Is on My Side, and some ZZ Top, good rock and roll, and yeah, I had good music.
You spent Christmas in your tent in the midst of a full snowstorm. How'd you celebrate?
I had a traditional Norwegian dinner, which is it's a lamb dinner, lamb meat, and dried and salted lamb meat. And then I also had something from home. I had some drawings from my son and letters from my parents and small things like that. And I actually had a very nice and quiet Christmas, and not having to stress around shopping for Christmas gifts as everybody else. So it was kind of good to be there. And the small things I got was just as valuable as any big and expensive gift which I might have got at home. So I liked it out there.
What did your son write and draw for you for your trip?
He actually drew my skis. And my skis were drawn with just small paintings of his own fantasy, dinosaurs, pirates, and you know what an 8-year-old can think of. So and to have those skis and to look at the skis were a very important motivation factor for me during the trek, and also to be able to keep me on the safe side if I had to, as I spoke about, take any chances. I knew that I have to come home and I have to do this safely. So those skis were important in at least two different ways.
I think your coldest day came the day after Christmas. It was minus 63 degrees Fahrenheit. Maybe it's not possible to describe what that feels like. What does it do to your hair, to your eyelashes, and to your skin in that extreme temperature?
Yeah, it chills you straight through to your bone, and that was very cold experience, obviously, and I had all my clothes on, still couldn't keep warm, and I actually didn't dare to stop. I knew that I just had to keep going to keep warm, and I skied for several hours until I was warm enough to put my tent up, so it was extremely cold, and I felt very, very small at that time and very vulnerable.
You had communicated with people. You were in contact via radio with your team, even though they didn't support you with food or other help. How did you navigate, or how did you together navigate?
I used most of the time when it was sun, I used my watch as a compass. And it's an old-fashioned method of keeping direction, and many people have forgotten how they do that. But I use my watch, and I use the sun, and then the shadow, which way the shadow points, because the sun at the local time, 12 o'clock in Antarctica, will point, and the shadow will point directly due south, and it moves 15 degrees each hour. So by looking at the shadow, my ski stick will make, I could just make the right angle with my ski, and then I would keep the right direction. So if it was sun up, I'd just use my watch and the sun, and taking my position at night in the tent and with GPS. It's a GPS satellite navigator to take the position.
It's the global positioning satellite?
Yeah, yeah.
And if anything happened to you, your team knew where you were.
Yeah, I had. I try always to have an independent safety system to be able to call help if the worst should happen. And one was the radio, and the other was a beacon who sent my position to the outside world via satellite, and so they could keep track of me all the time. That was on all the time. And the last thing was emergency beacon, which I always carried on my body.
I think you met with Sir Edmund Hillary. He's the first to scale Mount Everest, of course, and you went to the South Pole together on a little celebratory trip this January. What was that trip like? What did you all talk about?
Yeah, that trip was more or less like the icing of the cake for me. It was a victory trip to come back to the South Pole that way, just to spend the day and not having to ski for another 1,000 miles. So that was great, and especially being there with Sir Edmund Hillary, which is a man I admire a lot, and talking to him and feeling the same, thoughts, sharing the thoughts and having his response on my achievement, and also talking a little bit about his Everest achievements and all the similarities which are between us as adventurers. And that was a great moment.
What kind of war stories did you trade?
I think we talked about what I remember most is that we talked about the respect for nature, and that you don't go there to conquer nature, you want to work with the nature. And as he said, that I didn't conquer Everest let me do it. So I think that was what strikes my mind now.
After you come back, how long does it take before you get itchy again to get out of civilization?
It takes a while. It's a hard journey. Lots of sacrifice, lots of struggle. It's constant danger, which is a great pressure. So it does take a while. And your next question will probably be what I will do next time, but I don't have any specific plans. All my energy has been gone to plan this expedition and go through with that, and I haven't really had the opportunity to look beyond that. So I will just go back to Norway now and and settle down for a while, and then we'll see. I don't think I will do another major solo trip to the poles. I've been two times to the North Pole and two times to the South Pole, so I think I mean more or less have finished a chapter in my life when it comes to that. But maybe something totally different. We'll see.
Now you'll have to go somewhere hot.
Yeah, maybe a desert.
Borge Ausland, the first person to trek solo across Antarctica. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the many sides of the abortion debate. We talk with journalist Jennifer Gonerman about the diary of an Operation Rescue member which fell into the hands of a pro-choice activist. And journalist Peter Korn tells us about the year he spent observing the workings of an abortion clinic. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. The 24th anniversary of Roe v. Wade last month coincided with bombings on abortion clinics in three cities. Just last week, a 15-year-old boy was arrested on charges in the bombing of the clinic in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Although there's no evidence that these incidents are related, the violence directed at abortion providers over the past few years implies an escalation in the war on abortion. And at the forefront of the militant wing of the pro-life side stands Operation Rescue. My guest, Jennifer Gonerman, is a staff writer reporting on politics and criminal justice for The Village Voice. She recently obtained a diary written by Mark Harry Gabriel, a full-time operative for Operation Rescue's headquarters in Dallas. Gabriel kept the diary to record his tactics, successes, and failures in his picketing at family planning clinics around Dallas. In the past, Operation Rescue's activities have been well documented in the media. I asked Jennifer Gonerman what new light the diary shed on the workings of this particular pro-life organization.
I think the most incredible thing about the diary is that it actually exists. I mean, pro-choice people have long said that anti-choice activists were stalking doctors, jotting down the license plates of clinic workers and chasing them home. But to actually read this in Mark Gabriel's diary, Mark Gabriel being an intelligence gatherer for Operation Rescue at its national headquarters in Dallas, to actually read in his own words his day-to-day activities trying to gather intelligence and harass people in the pro-choice movement, particularly abortion doctors and clinic workers, is incredibly fascinating and compelling. His diary, which goes from August 1994 to March 1995, offers a rare look inside of Operation Rescue's strategy and tactics, and it really illustrates the kind of fervor that has driven some other protesters to go way too far in their effort to eliminate abortion.
One tactic Operation Rescue uses is to send anti-abortion activists into clinics undercover, posing as patients, and Gabriel calls them truth teams in his diary. What was the purpose of that strategy?
This is a sort of favorite anti-choice strategy, and the way Gabriel describes it in his diary, he talks about a fake mother-daughter team. So this would be two people not necessarily related who were part of Operation Rescue, who would schedule appointments and go into the family planning clinic. Then at a certain time that had been specified ahead of time, they would go to the door at the back of the clinic and open it and let in all their fellow Operation Rescue workers. And these people would come into the clinic. This is all described in Gabriel's diary. At least this was the plan they tried to execute on several occasions. These Operation Rescue protesters would come into the clinic of the waiting room and they would start, ranting and raving about abortion and try to convince those people in the waiting room not to go ahead with the abortion if that's why they were there. On other occasions, Gabriel would just charge in the front door with his fellow protesters and start preaching in the waiting room of the clinic. They would stick anti-choice literature inside the magazines in the waiting room, and they would also stick their own business cards inside the tray of the doctor. And these business cards would say things like, quote, Abortion Inc. serving all your baby-killing needs since 1973. So they certainly weren't subtle in their efforts to spread their anti-choice message.
Why did he keep the diary?
Well, I actually had to call Mark Gabriel for this Village Voice story, and it wasn't a phone call I was really eager to make since he didn't know this diary had been circulating among pro-choice people. But when I got him on the telephone, I told him I had the diary, and he sounded slightly stunned, but he did answer my question about why exactly he'd kept it. And he said that the reason he kept it is it was sort of notes that he was keeping for his own use, and he was later going to put them together into a newsletter and send them out to his supporters. Mark Gabriel seems to get his, I wouldn't say salary, but Mark Gabriel seems to get by on donations from individuals who support his cause. So I think he was going to summarize his activities as described in the diary in a newsletter which would be sent out to these supporters. And he told me, quote, every missionary needs to communicate with those that support him as a reason for why he kept the diary.
Did Gabriel reveal anything about his personal life in the diary?
He didn't reveal much. It seemed quite clear that he didn't seem to have much of a personal life. He appears to be unmarried. He's 36 years old. He's a former civil engineer, though he's not practicing that now. He seems so committed to the cause that the line between his professional and social life is completely blurred, and he appears to be close to the other people in Operation Rescue, and this really seems to be all-consuming in his life.
It's an interesting story how the diary got into your hands. Why don't you tell us about it?
I think this is sort of a fascinating twist in the whole story. And what happened is back in 1992, Operation Rescue, as well as a couple other anti-abortion groups and activists, mobilized thousands of people to try and shut down and interfere with clinic activities in Houston during the 1992 Republican convention down there, and they were somewhat successful, and then Planned Parenthood slapped them with a lawsuit. In 1994, Planned Parenthood won a $1.3 million judgment against Operation Rescue and another anti-abortion group and a couple of anti-abortion activists, and in order to pay off this judgment, the federal government seized Operation Rescue's assets. They seized their office equipment and then auctioned it off.
And then into the story enters a woman named Carol Adams, who is an abortion rights supporter. She's an animal rights activist. She's probably best known for a book called The Sexual Politics of Meat. She borrowed some money from her sisters, went to the auction, and for a little more than $3,000, she bought everything. She bought all 78 items that were being auctioned off.
Did she know what was in them?
She knew she was buying Operation Rescue's office equipment. She didn't know if there was going to be anything exciting on those computers, which is what she ultimately discovered. She bought printers and loudspeakers they used for protests, some of the same loudspeakers they actually used to protest outside her own home. Her husband is a prominent minister in town and a pro-choice minister and had been the target of some of Operation Rescue's wrath and protests. So after she bought 6 computers at the auction, she discovered Mark Gabriel's diary on one of them. She also discovered a list of media contacts and doctor's license plate numbers and mailing letters. But the juiciest bit that she got out of this auction was Mark Gabriel's 80-page diary, sort of an incredible find, I think, for the pro-choice movement.
I'd like to know if, in your reporting, you found any activities on the part of the pro-choice group that you found unethical.
Well, I think that I haven't discovered any that are unethical in my own reporting. But what I think is quite curious about this particular story is, on the one hand, you have Mark Gabriel with great glee attempting to infiltrate the anti-choice movement, you know, by covert and more obvious means. And to a certain extent, the exact same thing is happening on the other side. I mean, the two sides essentially believe they're engaged in a war or in a battle and will, you know, not by any means necessary, but almost attempt to get information about the other side and figure out what's going on. So the fact that a pro-choice supporter bought all of Operation Rescue's office equipment and then found this diary among other documents on their computers definitely shows that both sides are willing to go to varying extents, or both sides are willing to go to varying degrees to try and get information about the opposite side.
Jennifer Gonerman, thank you very much for talking with me today on Fresh Air.
Oh, thanks so much, Barbara.
Jennifer Gonerman is a staff writer for The Village Voice. Coming up, journalist Peter Korn reports on the year he spent observing a Portland, Oregon abortion clinic. This is Fresh Air. Peter Korn is a journalist who spent time with people on both sides of the abortion controversy. In 1995, he spent a year observing the workings of the Lovejoy Surges Center in Portland, Oregon. His book, Lovejoy, A Year in the Life of an Abortion Clinic, describes the frequent clashes between the staff and pro-life protesters, the doubts and fears of the patients seeking abortions, the experiences of the people who walk the picket line outside the clinic, and the finances of the for-profit abortion industry. Some people are disturbed by the idea of abortion as a business.
People I've spoken to about the book resent the salaries earned by the surgeons, $300,000 a year for a man doing abortions, when you depends on your context. If you compare that to what other surgeons are making who are doing different types of surgery, it's not out of line. If you think about it in the context solely of abortion, some people who have a problem with abortion have a problem with that salary. So no, I didn't. It's a hospital. If you ask Eileen Klass what she's got, she does not talk about an abortion clinic. She says, I have a fully licensed outpatient surgical center, which is absolutely true. These days, this is what the HMOs, where they want to send their patients, as opposed to hospitals. If she chose not to do abortions and just do plastic surgeries and knee reconstructions and the other outpatient surgeries, she'd make a lot more money than she's making now. Nobody will send their patients to, or very few doctors will send their patients for outpatient surgery to a place that does abortions, because if you're getting a knee reconstruction, why should you have to pass the picket line and go to a place associated with abortions and with the tensions incumbent thereof? It depends on how you look at it, and I think that's true of the whole book.
There's so much scrutiny and pressure on doctors and abortion facilities because of the political conflicts that you're talking about in this country, about the morality of abortion. What did you find the impact of that scrutiny is on care? Did you find that women are denied treatment because of the fear of complications, say, and that would reflect badly on the clinic, on abortion facilities in general?
No, I can't say I found that. What I do find, and which in the book is spoken to best by Carrie Ortman, the director of counseling, who is very upset at a couple of things on the national scene and how they affect care. One is she feels women are made to feel guilty by our society for going through this, that the whole thing is set up to discourage women, and that if they still go ahead and choose to have an abortion, that they will feel guilty and traumatized even more than they would otherwise for the rest of their lives. There's a stigma to abortion, and if a woman's going to have it, it's going to be tough enough on her personally. She wishes that weren't the case. This is sort of illuminated when she speaks. It was there's a scene in the book where a young woman, a teenage woman, I guess she's a young woman, I'm not even sure in some of these cases as I was watching, is this a girl or a woman? A teenager whose father brings her in along with the mother, but the mother is a passive sort who stays in the background. And the father has told her, this teenager is a good student, she's going to go to college in a couple of years, she's right on track, she made a mistake, she's pregnant. Her father says, you get an abortion, brings her in, drives her in, you get an abortion, you're not coming home tonight, you've got nowhere to stay, and you're not coming home at all. And this is a father and a daughter who are very close, by the way. This is not an estranged relationship. In fact, it was the dominant relationship of the family, that the father has been mentoring the daughter for years, and they're very close. And she still has to choose, and she comes into the counseling session and says, I don't believe in abortion. I'm there for the counseling session. This is what she's saying. What am I going to do? I'm kicked out of the house if I don't have it. Well, I won't go through the whole scene for you now, but at the end of which, Carrie's musing on what's just happened. At the end of the day, she's saying, I've always hated the phrase pro-choice. You tell me, did this girl have a choice? Most of the young women I see, or many of the women I see here, don't have a choice. They don't want to have an abortion. And she thinks that the pro-abortion movement, for lack of a better term, has done a disservice to women, has, again, stigmatized them by using that terminology.
It was a bit of a shock to me just how much abortions can cost. They do start at about $230 cash for a first trimester abortion. But of course, that doesn't include transportation costs if you're coming from far away, as many of these women must in order to find a clinic. And what was really surprising to me, that there is such a catch-22, that the longer a woman delays in making a decision, or the longer it takes just to raise enough money to pay for an abortion, the more expensive the procedure becomes. It's just like owing money, in a sense, to a loan shark. How do the clinic and the women deal with this vicious circle?
Well, actually, it's not just the clinic and the women, it's also the insurance companies, and it's fairly ludicrous, in fact. As HMOs have become bigger and bigger, outpatient surgical centers and all facilities are trying to get more and more of their business. It's the only way to stay in business, is to get their patients. They're locking up all the patients. But they drive a hard bargain in their contracts. A place like Lovejoy is constantly trying to get the HMOs in their region to make them the sole provider. In other words, if you're Kaiser Permanente, you would send all your abortion cases to Lovejoy Surgery Center if you get that contract, and Lovejoy does. Well, there's another HMO that they spend much of the year trying to court, and finally, when the negotiations get to it, this HMO agrees, okay, you're going to be our abortion provider. However, here's the deal. From 8 to 12 weeks, Lovejoy performs an abortion under just local anesthesia. From 15 weeks and above, they use a general anesthesia. There's a gray area here, 12 to 15 weeks, and some abortion providers will do that under local. At Lovejoy, the standard of care is that's always done under general anesthesia. That's their policy. In negotiating this contract with the HMO says, well, we're not going to pay for a general anesthetic for women who are between 12 and 15 weeks. And they're stuck here because Lovejoy says that's what we do. We believe women at 12 to 15 weeks need it. So when the final contract gets hammered out, wouldn't you know it, Lovejoy will do all their surgeries for this HMO up to 12 weeks and do them under local. They'll do the ones 15 weeks and beyond, and they'll do it under general. But any women who belong to this particular HMO who want an abortion between 12 and 15 weeks cannot get it at Lovejoy. Well, what are they most likely to do? They're most likely to wait a few weeks until they're 15 weeks and above, and then their provider will pay for it. But now they're getting the further along you go in your pregnancy before you get an abortion, the more dangerous it is, significantly. Quantum leaps here in terms of infection. So they're encouraging more dangerous operations.
Peter Korn is my guest. He's a journalist. He's written for Self, Discovery, Wired, The Nation, and other national publications. His new book covers 1 year in the life of an abortion clinic in Portland, Oregon, called Lovejoy Surges Center. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with journalist Peter Korn. His new book about an abortion clinic in Portland, Oregon is called Lovejoy. You also spent a lot of your time investigating the leading abortion protest group in Portland that targeted Lovejoy. It's called Advocates for Life Ministries. I'm curious how well you got to know that group and how much access they allowed you as an observer.
They allowed me tremendous access. It's not just them. It's also I spent part of the year in a prison in Kansas with Shelley Shannon, who is a member of Advocates for Life, who shot an abortion doctor, Dr. Tiller, in Kansas, in Wichita, who also was involved with Lovejoy, who firebombed Lovejoy. It's a scene in the book. Everybody on that side really allowed me to be with them all the times on protests and planning sessions. I don't know if there's a scene early in the book where they're talking about their strategies for the coming year, and I was amazed they would allow me to, the strategy being they weren't just going to do their Saturday protests at the doctors and major administrators. They were, which wasn't that effective. For years they've been doing that, you know, pickets surrounding the houses and yelling things and that sort of thing. Why not target the nurses and the receptionists, they decide? These people are making $7, $8, $9 an hour, and maybe if we give them enough grief and have all their neighbors seeing what's going on and that sort of thing, that they'll figure it isn't worth the grief. So this is before they had done this, talking about strategy. As to why, I think it was pretty obvious. The militant, and we're talking about the militant arm of the anti-abortion movement, is caught in a paradox. And this is well played in the book. Perhaps rather than tell you, I'll show you just as in the book. We have a scene where they're doing their big protest at the home of Aline Klass, the main figure, the woman who started and has run Lovejoy all these years, despite the protests and the death threats and everything else. They're going to hold a Saturday morning protest at her home. Five people show up. This is a national organization. Well, let me just tell you what happens. Five people show up. They parade in front of her house with pickets that hardly anybody takes notice of. If anybody in the house does, I'm not even sure. And they leave after an hour. And I'm sitting there watching this and thinking it's sort of pathetic. This is supposed to be one of the most powerful groups in the country fighting against abortion. They get five people. They used to get 300. And the reason they only get five now is because in recent years they've embraced the militant, it's okay to shoot the doctors, promoting that plan of action. And most of the people who are anti-abortion are not that militant. So this is what their organization has come to. No power, right? Wrong. The next day, they're on the front page of the New York Times. A big story about Andrew Burnett and Advocates for Life and others. Not about the protest. There was no reporter at the protest, but about the militancy about, as doctors are getting shot, fewer and fewer doctors are willing to perform abortions, and fewer hospitals are willing to have them performed. And so, in fact, the small minority is having a great impact on the field. But given all that, getting publicity, having people know about them is important, and I think that's one of the reasons they let me in.
Andrew Burnett is the head of Advocates for Life Ministries and publishes their newsletter. So he found that his extremism was a much more powerful tool to wield with the media's help than building up, shoring up support, building up membership.
I was doing a talk in Brattleboro, Vermont last week at the town library, and there were members. I was really enjoying it because there were members of Right to Life there as well as abortion rights supporters. I'm trying not to use the phrase pro-choice here. And the reason I liked it, because we got a little bit of a dialogue going, which is what I'm trying to do with the book. It wasn't just everybody yelling at each other. And one of the people from Right to Life asked me, why in a book such as this do you highlight people like Andrew Burnett and the most militant groups as opposed to the, you know, millions of anti-abortion mainstream people? And the answer I gave her was that, like it or not, these are the ones that are having the most political impact. That years and years of political protests by Right to Life have not, in fact, put a stop to abortions in this country. But in fact, the shooting of abortion doctors, the escalating of the violence has. Most doctors do not want to have to wear Kevlar vests going to work. It's working, though. It's a small minority.
You do describe the more mild-mannered abortion clinic picketers. I'm thinking of a man named John. He's a retired high school teacher and a sports coach. And he does picket with this group, who Advocates for Life Ministries, with their very extreme leader who advocates murder of abortion doctors. He pickets with them, and it seems surprising he would ally himself with that group. Maybe you could tell us about him.
Well, he's part of he's more of the gray area that I'm talking about, only his is not between abortion or not abortion. It's where to be on that political spectrum. He's firmly against abortion. Believe it's murder. This is a man I really liked when I spoke to him. Very likable man, a grandfatherly type. He's never had children of his own. He says, my children are my life. He's always been a teacher and a coach, summer camp counselor. And he doesn't know what to do because he recognizes everything I just spoke about. He recognizes his having come out to Lovejoy every year, every Saturday for the last 20 years and protested and handed out literature. He might have had an occasional woman who he thinks looked his way, took his literature, and chose not to have the abortion, but he's not fooling himself. There hasn't been much of an impact. And Andrew Burnett, as he points out, is doing something that is effective. He's aware of it. I think he says Andrew Burnett is the only one who's telling it like it is. On the other hand, John is completely opposed to the idea of shooting abortion doctors, and he's stuck in the middle between his belief that abortion is murder and the only way to be effective in stopping that, which seems to be Andrew Burnett's policies, and simply sitting there or standing there every Saturday holding his placard, which is not having much effect. What I liked was when he told me he is not supporting Andrew Burnett, and there was a sort of hitch in his voice as he told me that. It was hard for him to say that. He doesn't believe in it. No, the man is wrong. And then he told me there's an envelope that sits on the dresser in his bedroom, and he looks at it every morning. And it's an envelope for Advocates for Life, Andrew Burnett's group, desperately in search of money. It's a fundraising envelope. He hasn't put in money yet, but he's had it on his dresser for years, and every day he looks at it, he can't decide what's the right thing for him to do. And to me, that's a perfect illustration of the gray area for people who are against abortion rights.
On one hand, there are probably not that many people out there working at abortion clinics just to make a living because, of course, they have to be dedicated to risk the violence. But on the other hand, I would think that the danger of our current situation is that extremists are created on both sides of the conflict.
Very true. Very true. In fact, it's not just the extremism. When I set out to do this book, the one rule of thumb I was working by was I wanted to try to humanize everybody involved, and I wanted to try to do it fairly and objectively, but I thought if nothing else, if I could make people see that all the people involved in this controversy, all the people we've spoken up about until now, are real human beings, and most of them have integrity, that I would have done a service because I don't think on either side of the lines people see the other side that way. And obviously, if you're able to shoot an abortion doctor, you don't feel that that person is a fully realized human being. He's just an icon to you. But it works the other way, too. Shelley Shen and Andrew Burnett talking to some of the people inside. Granted, some of the people inside the facility have spent years being terrorized by these people, and it's natural in a state of stress like that, almost a combat readiness situation, that you would start to see your adversaries not as human beings, but just as icons, as figures, not as people. But in fact, they all are. In fact, they're all fascinating people. And I think if we could just get to the point where we would recognize that, maybe some of the level of discussion could tone down a bit and we could start talking a little more evenly about abortion and not thinking that the other side, whoever believes opposite, is just the enemy and nothing more.
Peter Korn, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Peter Korn is the author of Lovejoy, A Year in the Life of an Abortion Clinic. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Chris Fraley, Dan Lachlan, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave. Thank you.